Part 4, Further Analysis and Discussion.
Hello and welcome to Further Analysis and Discussion. This week in Further Analysis and Discussion, we're kicking it off with a little bit of a Freudian slip, if you know what I mean. So we're slipping into our strengths or weaknesses of Sigmund Freud. So what do we like about Sigmund Freud? What do we dislike about Sigmund Freud? That's a poor word. What are the weaknesses of his theory? Where's he gone wrong? Why aren't we all Freudians?
Okay, so strengths first. Are we starting with strengths?
Sorry, I didn't make that very clear.
No, you didn't at all, Jack.
Strengths of Sigmund Freud.
Perfect. Okay, so what I like about Sigmund Freud is, as much as there's lots of things that I do disagree with him on, I like the fact that he's looking at the behavior that he sees in his patients and the people around him and forming his theories based on that. There's a lot of research that went into the five stages of development. There's a lot of research that went into the ideas of the id, the superego, and the ego. And what I like about him is, although he may not be a philosopher in the traditional sense, he's in similar leagues to a long line of empiricist philosophers that take the a posteriori knowledge around them and form their ideas based on the evidence they see. Now, we may disagree with that today in terms of our understanding of psychology and the mind, etc. But at his time, in the early 20th century, no one had even made even a fifth of the amount of progress that Freud made in his lifetime in the study of dreams, in the study of the mind, the study of psychoanalysis and psychology. And I think that his research in this field really pushed this very new science ahead very, very quickly. And that even though I'm not completely convinced by some of the finer details, and I think that he paints in quite broad strokes, so to speak, I do like the ideas of the unconscious. And I think that's something that definitely affects people more than they are aware.
Yeah, I think the real strength to be taken away is the movement of looking towards the unconscious mind. The fact that before this, as he's probably quite rightly saying, I mean, the work of philosophy is so much about how we reason and how much control human beings have over their behaviors. And that when comparing with Aquinas and kind of saying that, you know, human beings can quite rightly be able to determine how they live and try and aim towards their telos. I mean, Freud's kind of saying, but like, maybe that you can't, like, maybe there are certain things that happen in development that really kind of affect your behaviors, and you have to work incredibly hard to overcome those, and a lot of people don't manage it. Funnily, I think we mentioned this when we did Sartre. Sartre really wasn't a fan of Freud's work either. And you can see why, because existentialism is always about human freedom. And what Freud is saying is actually we have quite a severe lack of freedom. And I think, well, maybe it's yet to be completely decided by psychology and science, like just how much the unconscious mind does affect our behavior. I think it's without a doubt, most people would have to say that there are unconscious parts of the mind that do drive our behaviors, whether that's through evolutionary science or psychology. But this is unquestionable now. This is part of the way our human minds work.
Would Freud say that we are determined? Would he be a determinist, would you think, Andy?
I don't think he would be a complete determinist, because he would say that like psychoanalysts would be able to kind of get to the root of why people are experiencing certain behaviors that they dislike. So if you were perhaps feeling you had this neurosis where you were constantly feeling guilty and you felt very depressed all the time, and that then meant that all of your behaviors stemmed through depression, you could say if you never addressed that, you would live in depression for most of your life, and maybe that in a way is quite hard determined. But Freud would probably say, if you addressed it in the correct way, if you can find out what these repressed feelings that you're having that are causing the problems, once they are addressed, you can actually take steps in approaching and changing. Whether or not that's possible for everyone, I'm not sure Freud would say.
Freud himself, the founder of psychoanalysis, there is definitely still a place for psychoanalysis within psychology and within therapy. You know, link this in with a weakness at the same time, unfortunately, because it can't go without saying simultaneously. I've been looking a lot at the role of the law and therapy and the ethics of this and the consistency of law over the last year, and how the problems with people who have been to see psychoanalysts often dig up. I think it's on page 3 or 4 of The Ego and the Id. Freud says, it's clear which memories which come to our conscious mind from the repressed id. It's clear which ones of these are real and which ones are not. Well, is it? You know, if I think back to when I'm 4, 5, 6, I can't distinguish what was a dream, what was my daydream, a hallucination, or what was actually real. I find it very difficult to distinguish between these things when you try and think about it. So there's been a lot of people who sued the parents and things like this for abuse, which didn't actually occur. So it's a very, very dangerous game. In the right hands, I am a big fan of psychoanalysis, but in the wrong hands, this can go horrifically wrong. Is it a criticism of Freud? I don't think so, because, you know, he's happy to say you can really repress stuff, and the stuff which hasn't been repressed there, it's just in the background of your conscience. You might pull up the wrong things. I'm aware of that. That's fine. And that, I think that does justice to the fluidity and the leeway Freud has got. Because like Andy said, I don't think you can refute this theory. You can poke holes in it, but there's nothing which is going to let the hot air balloon down anytime soon. So back to a strength. Freud's theory is very robust. It seems to me to explain conscience. Now, that's not to say that it does completely, but when you ask questions, why does our conscience develop? Why is God concerned with whether or not I pick up the 5 pence after the bus ticket man gives me 35 pence change and I leave 5 behind? Why does God care about the seatbelt thing when he didn't seem to care quite a long time ago? Aquinas can answer these questions, yes, but it goes back to what we said about Aquinas. This seems like a ramble, but here's the ultimate point. If you are a naturalist, you know, you're not looking for supernatural explanations or things that go beyond the empirical, the physical world, Freud seems to give us a robust and, quite frankly, a clear explanation of why and how the conscience works. It seems to answer the question we've addressed very well.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of conscience, I like the idea that the conscience, from Freud's point of view, is kind of the result of almost kind of like a social conditioning. I think that kind of makes sense to me. But in terms of weaknesses, I really, really struggle with the Oedipus complex being the kind of formation of the superego. I think that it just seems completely out of the blue. And I just feel like that even if you could argue that it's an unconscious desire, and that obviously the repression of that desire manifests itself in anger and guilt and things like that, I just don't buy it. That's really bad philosophy, but I just think it's a little silly.
I'm going to disagree. I'm going to be a bit Freudian with anecdote here as the response in the Freudian spirit. I buy the Oedipus complex. I think this is right. And if you don't, then I'm afraid you're repressing it, Ollie. It's clearly something that everyone goes through. I literally recall myself saying it because my elder sister has reminded me, she does psychology, and she's brought this up a few times as an antidote, so I may as well use it myself. I remember saying to my mum when I was 5 or 6, "Mom, you know, can I marry you when I'm older?" And she says, "No, I'm married to your dad." And then
Jack proceeded to kill his dad.
Marry his mother.
No, but I remember that clear as day. Is it grounded in sexual desire? I don't think so. But is it grounded? Is the Oedipus complex a thing? You know, if something gives you lots of pleasure, nourishment, and brings you into the world, it makes sense. Come on, it doesn't seem...
But do you think that, like, women want to have penis envy and stuff like that?
This is really controversial ground now. So I'm not sure he's nailed it with the reverse Oedipus complex. Perhaps, you know... Bono might be right. It might be power envy, which is completely consistent. Men in the wild and in the animal kingdom, for the most part, the more powerful thing is the stronger thing is the one that rules the roost. And you can see why you might be envious of this. That seems consistent as well.
Can I interject here? I think one of the criticisms that you could actually put towards Freud is that he's putting almost, and correct me if I'm wrong, but almost all of the emphasis is on outside influences onto the human subject, and that most, if not all, of our personalities seem to be informed by the behaviors of other people and our reflections on those, and that is what creates either a sense of superego or your ego and how you look at the world. But there are definitely scientific circles that would say that that would reject a lot of what genetics brings to the table, and that no matter like how you were brought up by your mother or your father, that you might actually be more inclined to be an aggressive person no matter how you were taught or what male influence you had. And that Freud is being way too generous and thinking that like your sexual orientation would be or could be very altered at that stage just because you happen to have related more to the female presence than the male, and that maybe that's actually not how that would develop at all. Now, I think it's not as easy as just saying it's one or the other. It could be a mixture of both. But my point is that he seems to be throwing all of his eggs in the kind of development basket and not just the genetics.
So I don't think he's giving it. I don't think he's... First of all, he hasn't explained everything, given a complete picture within these 80 pages. No, we're not saying that. But what I'm saying is what you've just said, perhaps it is a straw man of Freud. And I'll tell you why, and you can perhaps tell me where you think I've gone wrong. Genetics, the id, right? This is fine. You say, well, perhaps homosexuality and heterosexuality is defined not just by development. Maybe there's something instinctual, something genetic there. And perhaps there are things that we do that are instinctual, genetic, and driven by something other than development. That's fine. That's all the id. And yes, you might be more inclined to be homo or heterosexual by the id alone, because as we've seen through our exploration of Freud, that previous egos and superegos can imprint on the id and take it forward to the next. So this is fine for Freud. Yes, people might be more inclined to follow their instincts than other people, seek pleasure, and you see this in society all the time, or perhaps all of your ancestors were more inclined to be heterosexual, and then you're more persuaded by that, by the definition of your id. That's fine again for Freud. It's just the imbalance. He's not saying this is a one size fits all. He's not saying this is a size 8, it fits everybody. He's saying this is a one size fits all shoe, and it depends how big the foot is when it goes in the shoe and the development which it's going to go running around in.
Yeah, I mean, but then maybe that's a criticism that could be leveled at Freud, which is that because it's almost like so general that no matter how a psychoanalyst approaches a patient, there is always a way to draw it back to what Freud had said. And that comes back to that kind of falsifiability claim that I made right at the start, which is that like a psychoanalyst could have someone on a couch, have them describe their feelings, and that you could always say like, ah, see how this ties back to the Oedipus complex. It's all simple. Mm-hmm. And the, by giving this framework means that it perhaps, and like you said, maybe this is not Freud, it's just people who are using the Freudian model can quite easily read what they want to into it. It gives them a set of answers that they can give to the patient, which then might actually miss a lot of the important subtleties that will be missed.
And that's, again, we've picked up on this in the problems which psychoanalysis actually brought to the forefront of courts and things like this. And interesting, just as a side note, if you go and see a therapist, I think this detracts a few people from going to see one, but it's important everyone knows, data protection and things like this, if you went to court, say if Ollie murdered Andy or vice versa, you're on trial for it, any public record the court has access to. So if you went to see a psychoanalyst and they found out you had the Oedipus complex or something like this, and you're accused of killing your mother, that could be used against you in court. So a lot of people avoid psychoanalysts for that reason, but I don't recommend doing so unless you're planning on killing anyone in the future. That was a mild side point. Concluding remarks on Freud. Let's draw our analysis up. Let's draw a conclusion let's do Freud and the conscience specifically. What is Freud's view of the conscience do for you as an explanation to the question, what is conscience? Does Freud fully explain what conscience feels like? And are there any shortcomings to his explanation?
So I like the idea that he has the Freud's idea of the mind is it's kind of these always these conflicting forces of the id and the superego, and they're kind of at odds with each other, and it's the ego that kind of balances them out, and that kind of paints the conscience not as kind of just one thing. It's a combination of forces working together that's completely influenced by your upbringing, you know, your social conditioning, the environment you live in. And to that extent, the conscience is quite elastic. It's quite flexible, that although there are those kind of social norms that we, most people adhere to, that the conscience is something that's quite elastic. You know, if you took a group of people and put them on Mars, their idea, and created some very odd social rules, convinced them that the color green was evil or something, then that would be formed into their conscience as their collective understanding. Cool. Like so it's quite elastic, maybe, and like, you know, can change. And I think that's something that's like, I agree with that completely. I think that's a strength. I think that the conscience is, you know, we know through the studies of the brain that the brain itself changes the way that you access information and the way that you store information. You know, when you go through puberty, your brain literally rewires itself. It's quite a miraculous thing, really. So for me, I think that's a very part of the conscience that I agree with completely. I think it's not just one solid, this is good, this is bad. I think it changes. And I like that idea that it's kind of like two or three conflicting forces at once.
That's an important distinction between Aquinas and Freud, isn't it? And we'll get onto this in a second, that conscience for Freud changes, whereas Aquinas, the moral content never changes. It's just...
God never changes, Jack.
Yeah, so if you don't subscribe to like a moral objective fact, then Freud's going to seem quite good to you, I think, because, yeah, it explains why different cultures have different values and the way that they behave. And even within your own culture, you can kind of look around and see, like, well, so somebody who is perhaps like socially conservative, who might think that gay rights is a bad thing, and that marriage is to be done before having children because it promotes certain values. This is all stuff that they've been brought up in. There's nothing explicitly about human behavior. Well, Aquinas would perhaps argue otherwise, that like people feel like they have to have this particular type of marriage or something like that. It depends on who your parents were, what you value, maybe what like role models from pop culture and stuff, like the stuff that you've kind of internalized will be how you feel. So
a really good example for that is eating cats and dogs. So in some areas of the world, eating cats and dogs is a perfectly, you know, if you eat cows or chickens or whatever, why wouldn't you eat cats and dogs? But I guarantee you, especially in the UK, maybe even the US and other Western countries as well, if you walked around and you were like, if your cat died, would you eat it? They'd be like, that's disgusting. That's like morally wrong. Why would you do that? Mm. And that's completely like what supports what Andy just said.
It yeah,
and
supports
a very good example.
And also, and particularly good because like, I reckon there would be the people that would say like, logically, there's no reason why I shouldn't like eat the cat over the cow, but they would still have this feeling within them, perhaps the superego that says like, no, even if you try to logically tell me that eating the cat is no different than the cow, I'll still think it's wrong because it's so ingrained into what you've been told since birth that that's the way in which you have a relationship with these animals.
Since birth, you've been told, Andy, don't eat your cat. Yeah. It's cute and furry. Don't eat it.
So conscience is the product of my development. It's conflicting with the developed part of my id, which is my ego, which tells me what I can achieve through my ego reality principle. And this seems to ring very true to me. I don't think my conscience is the consequence of me working out some a priori reasoning in the Kantian sense or in Aquinas' sense. I don't think it's me using my ratio and using the synderesis principle to reflect on that and then uncover the five primary precepts. I haven't reflected on these things. I don't know that those five primary precepts are what I should follow. And the acts which... I don't even think that Joseph Fletcher and Aquinas are right when they say that conscience is just the act, it's just the act of moral decision making. The conscience feels like something which informs you of something. It seems to linking back to part one, it seems to be someone conspiring against you. What's conspiring against you? Well, that's your Freudian superego. And this seems to be what people have known for 2,500 years when we look at the history of the word. It seems to have changed on the hinge of St. Paul, and you can see why Aquinas is taking the view that he has, given that he has the horse in the race, which is his religious belief. I'm not using the word burdened to set anything against the belief in the existence of God in this context, but I'm not burdened with having to reconcile the existence of my conscience with a God. I can point to something very naturalistic. My conscience is just the byproduct of the physical world, my development. And this seems very true. There's some problems with Freud in terms of psychoanalysis and some of the other things which he said. He's written a great body of work, and perhaps he's even wrong with the superego, the id, and the ego. But what Freud does seem to get right, for me, is that conscience is something that develops.
Yeah, so I would agree with you about the idea that the conscience develops. But I think Aquinas would have no issue with that as well, because while there might be this synderesis, this idea of these natural principles that we're inclined to do, he still thinks, as we were saying before, that the role of the conscientia is to learn and develop and like through practice and knowledge become aware of how to react in certain situations. And that Aquinas, I think, we shouldn't ever get to the point where we're thinking Aquinas just kind of is along the lines of saying God tells us what to do. And not that that's what you were saying, but I think I think Aquinas actually has some similarities with Freud to an extent. They're not so different. He does believe that children have to develop and learn how to behave. Mm. He doesn't just think that if you took a child, took them out into the woods, and then they came back as an adult, that they would be able to suddenly walk into society and be able to act as way the way God intended.
They have to cultivate the virtues to do this. But the cultivation of virtues is very distinct from developing the moral content of the five primary precepts, right? When it comes down to it, our telos, fulfilling our telos is moral, and to do so is immoral. It's going against God's plan.
Yeah.
Right? But for Freud, the moral content isn't developed. If you put someone out in the woods for 5 years, then still when they come out the woods, the primary precepts are still instilled by God, our Savior and Lord. But for Freud, you take someone to the woods for 5 years, there was nothing when you went in there, there's nothing when you came out. It's whatever happens on your journey which is going to decide what your moral content is.
But I think Aquinas would argue the same thing. I think that he would end up having to say that there would be such a small connection to God that your reasoning would be lost. That, like, while these principles might still be within you, you're still a human made in the image of God. You never were able to have even a chance because you didn't get to experience the Bible and you didn't get to experience, like, your parents and your guardians teaching you, how to behave. I just don't think that he thinks that you could take somebody, isolate them, and that they would still just naturally end up okay. They might know, they might still have a sense of good. Like, I think Aquinas would probably say, like, a human being wouldn't just automatically decide to try and kill people at all, which is where you might want to disagree with him. But we don't know that. I still think even if you took a human being and isolated them mostly, or like we said earlier, like maybe raised by wolves as a feral child, I think they would still have an understanding when they saw another human being, as terrified as they might be, that they would have some connection. They must have some recognition there that that is another human being, and that they wouldn't necessarily go straight to killing them or anything like that.
So just to clarify here, I want to make this really, really clear. So if we take Freud and Aquinas and we kind of compare their views towards the conscience, or just kind of broader than that. So is Aquinas going to say that there are absolute, is there an absolute morality or teleology that everybody should follow?
Yes. Okay. Which is definitely where Freud would completely disagree with that.
He would say that the conscience is a result of your social conditioning, and that there is no objective moral reality for Freud, that there's no God, it's your collective conscious all kind of developing together as a culture and making sure that you're safe from aggression from other societies and cultures. If we want to look at like a really clear difference, Freud doesn't believe in an objective morality and Aquinas does.
Yeah.
So if we're looking at the development of the conscience, then would Aquinas argue, even though he's saying that the conscience does develop, that it's not just a held in place thing, that there is a right kind of conscience that you should develop?
Well,
is that what Aquinas would say?
Well, not that. Yeah, there's not a right kind of conscience that you should develop. If you just think about it enough, you'll just get the right conscience, which is objectively right.
See, I think this is where perhaps
not conscience.
Though. Yeah. So he seems to come along the lines that the synderesis is going to say that there are certain natural inclinations that human beings aim towards when we're looking at them as a whole. So if you focus on one single individual, it becomes difficult because we're looking at natural inclinations across everybody. So like I said earlier, there might be the occasional person that has no desire to reproduce, and Aquinas seems to think that that's fine, because as long as the species as a whole is doing that, then having single individuals that don't pursue that end is somewhat fine. It might not be the perfect way for a human being to live, but actually that seems to work. And that really, I think all I'm trying to stress is that Aquinas is not going to say that a human being if particularly taught all of the wrong things and is like beaten as a child and is told that you should go and beat other people and that's okay, that somehow if they just reason carefully enough, they'll be led back to God's path. I think he's going to say that it's going to be so difficult to do that. He's not going to just say that like God will find a way.
Isn't he kind of forced to though, in a way?
I think.
Could you argue that he kind of has to say that, even if he doesn't think it's the case?
I think he says that he'll always come back to the point where it's like everything is possible with God, and that like that person could become good again. But I still don't think he's going to say it's likely. I think he's also working off Aristotle here. Aristotle argued that if certain cardinal virtues weren't taught as a child, that they were basically never going to get it. And so maybe the God part inclines Aquinas to want to believe that they will get it, but is that actually the case? I'm not so certain.
You remind me nicely of Mac from Always Sunny in Philadelphia. There, have you seen this? When someone says to it, "That's impossible," and Mac goes, "No, first of all, anything's possible with God," and then he just carries on with a normal explanation.
Yeah, yeah. That's the best argument to be any other. Yeah.
But yeah, so we've just gone on like a quite a big discussion there, but just to really again make it very clear, all I'm arguing is that Aquinas also thinks that outside influences does affect the conscience, that your moral development is developed throughout your life. You're not going to just suddenly be a perfect being that follows your telos, because if that was the case, why wasn't everybody currently doing that?
Okay, good. A common criticism flown by William Lane Craig. William Lane Craig is a theist, a philosopher who debates people about the existence of God. He uses very strict philosophical arguments, which are very frustrating for his opponents. Very irregularly goes off script. And one of his very scripted points is he strawmans the atheist quite a lot. He'll say, well, if God doesn't exist, where do your objective moral values come from? He's often read their book and he'll say, oh, Stephen Law, you admit they're objective moral values. So explain why there are objective moral values if there is no God. Fantastic. Okay, good. Here's a Freudian account. And William Lane Craig often paraphrases this as, well, morals and conscience only develops because it's simply unfashionable for the evolutionary naturalist. You know, we think that rape and murder and pillaging are all wrong because it was unfashionable and you'd be killed out the tribe. It's not beneficial for evolution. And Freud could be thrown under the William Lane Craig bus here. For Freud, there are no objective moral values. They're all just developed. Yes, something might become unfashionable so much over 6 billion years to the extent that it's ingrained in all our ids, and it might be really close to being absolute. Give it 6 billion more, and this is quite a flexible moral. So Freud can be thrown into that bus, unfortunately. But what motivation do we have for thinking that morals aren't objective? Freud gives us a very good one. It's very fashionable for young people, especially when you go to university. If you're at university, if you've been lucky enough to study philosophy, first years often come with the pre-existing belief that morals are just something that we invent. You know, morals aren't objective and distinct from human beings. There's no objective moral values in the world. They're all just human made. This is a popular idea at the moment. And if you want to hold that view, I suggest looking at people like Freud and educating yourself on these issues rather than just getting dreadlocks and kicking around a hacky sack of an evening.
On your high horse there, Jim.
Yeah, wow.
I have owned a hacky sack before, so.
Philosophical ultimatum.
The return of philosophical ultimatum. Hang up your stockings, get the mince pies out. It's that time of year again. Welcome back to Philosophical Ultimatum. Mr. Andrew Horn's jingle goes a little bit something like this.
Siggy!
And Mr. Ollie's Marley's jingle goes a little bit something like this.
Tommy boy.
Welcome back to Philosophical Ultimatum. Have you missed it? Have you missed the game?
Miss is a strong word, but maybe it's repressed down there somewhere where I feel like I'm desperately wanting approval from my audience.
When I'm not thinking about killing my father and sleeping with my mother, I'm often thinking about Philosophical Ultimatum.
I am too, but unconsciously, hence why it's popped back up for this week's episode. Right, so jingles at the ready. We're playing best of five. You give a complete answer. You remember the rules, don't you? I give you a question. You both give me a full answer. You buzz to get the right answer quick enough and explain it. But if you get the opposite, I judge you on the merits of your arguments, as you both know.
Which you really enjoy, don't you, Jack?
So there's five questions. Question number one. How does Aquinas's view of guilt differ from Freud's?
Siggy! I mean, again, I'm not sure how we can give, like, different answers too much. Okay. Wait, so what's the question again?
Tommy boy! Right, okay, so Freud is going to say that guilt is a manifestation of your superego. So when your superego is kind of faced with these authority figures, all of that id, aggression, and libido is kind of repressed, and that manifests itself in guilt. Aquinas is going to say that guilt is when you are aware through the combination of your...
So this is why I paused, because we can't give two different answers.
Jack, I'm not really sure about these rules. So, Andy, would you like to explain what Aquinas thinks about guilt?
Okay, what he would say is that because we have this underlying Sindarist principle saying that we should avoid evil and pursue the good, that when we don't do those things, particularly if we pursue like the privation of good knowingly, then our conscience will specifically kind of tell us and say, like, look, this is wrong, and you know it's wrong because, like, you've understood what the primary precepts are and that you're going against it. And even if you were, like, let's say, going back to those key words, if you brought in the idea of invincible ignorance and you weren't certain, that once you learnt that actually what you did was wrong, you would then start to feel that guilt about the action you did. So it's always the fact that you feel guilt when you are not following your natural law, you're not aiming towards your telos.
Gonna give Andrew Horton the point there, because the rules were dispelled by Ollie Marley. Your superego should have taught you otherwise. It's 1-0 to Andy, obviously playing best out of five. Second question. Is God important to our ideas of the conscience? Please reference Aquinas and Freud in your answers.
Siggy! I'll give Freud this time, and Ollie can take Aquinas. For Freud, he's going to say that God does not play any part. The idea of God's command telling us what it is actually a misunderstanding, that it's actually the father figure, that kind of ego ideal, which is telling us the rights and the wrongs. We internalize that, and that the reason why the religion has become such a thing is because we're searching for a father figure that continues to tell us and guides us towards what we're doing. So Freud would say, no, we don't need God to tell us how to behave. The conscience through the superego develops these strong rules, these do's and don'ts, and that it's the ego's job to then translate that rationally into the world around them.
Tommy boy. So Aquinas is going to argue the complete opposite. God is incredibly important to understanding the conscience. In fact, you couldn't have a conscience without God. So Aquinas is going to argue that your God-given reason gives you the ability to understand the natural law. Natural law are the precepts and rules that God has made for you to fulfill your telos, to reach your ultimate purpose, which is obviously, you know, to fulfill your telos, to kind of reach perfection with God. And he's going to say that although your conscience is split into two different sections, so the conscientia is the understanding, the abilities of the understanding of the natural moral law, and interpreting the rules given to you by God.
2-0 to Mr. Andrew Horton there. No reason needs to be given. Unless you want to request your papers, you can email me at don'tgiveamonkeys@monkeys.com. The third question, on the process of decision making, how does Aquinas's and Freud's views differ?
Siggy, I'll go Aquinas this time. So as actually Ollie's given quite a lot of answers on this on the previous one, to make a moral decision for Aquinas, he asks you to do a couple of things. He wants you to reflect on the natural inclinations that you have to be able to discover what these primary precepts are. And that once you have an outlining of those, he also then asks you to use prudence, and he wants you to look at the biblical teachings. He wants you to look at the society, providing that it's a well-run society based upon the laws of God. And you might want to consult your priests, but more importantly, you have to eventually consult your reason, your ratio. And this is what the consensus is all about. So to make a moral choice, you see Ollie mugging Jack, and that when I'm viewing this, I have to reflect upon the natural law and the will of God, and then say, right, I know that's wrong because, and then I take action on those things. So it's always a reflection using reasoning for Aquinas. That's how the conscience works.
Tommy boy. So from Freud's perspective, in terms of moral decision making, Freud doesn't believe in objective moral facts. He doesn't believe in God. What he's going to say is that the conscience will influence your moral decision making, and the conscience is a combination of the ego and the superego. And the superego is influenced by authority figures that you've had in your life, going from your parents, in terms of teaching you how to live in the society that you've grown up in, as a form of kind of cultural conditioning. So that the culture that you live in effectively gives you these morals that you develop, and that it's completely influenced by that environment. So, for example, if I walk down the street and I see Andy mugging Jack, if I'm following, I see from Freud's perspective, he's going to say, okay, so you are culturally conditioned to preserve each other because you're trying to reduce the amount of aggression that comes from the id. You should probably try and get rid of this aggression, because if everyone just started mugging everyone, society would fall apart and we wouldn't be able to reproduce and obviously carry on our species.
So that is 3-2-1 to Mr. Andrew Horton. That's Ollie's point. Right, what's up? You don't seem too happy with the point allegation.
No, so. I wasn't sure what you said before that. No, that's cool. I'm more than happy with the point.
Fantastic. So that's 2-1 to Ollie then. Question number 4. Is conscience linked to, or is it separate from, reason and the unconscious mind?
Tommy boy. So I'm going to take Aquinas this time. So Aquinas is going to say that... Wait, what is Aquinas going to say?
That it's reason.
That it's reason. The conscience is reason. It's not the unconscious mind. It's not the unconscious
mind. Yeah.
Because he doesn't believe in a conscious mind.
Good.
So Aquinas would say that he doesn't believe in an unconscious mind. This was an idea that was around in his time in the 13th century. He's going to say that in terms of your conscience, it is a combination of two forces coming together, the synderesis and the conscientia, and that obviously this helps you inform your moral decision-making by combining the natural moral law. I feel like we're going around in circles. The natural moral law.
I've got a little thing to add with this as well.
Okay.
So yeah. I can chime in.
Yeah, combining natural moral law and your God-given reason to help you reach your telos and obviously fulfill what you've got to do.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something here, because it's not something we've really talked about, but it's worth noting just for this particular question, is that, because I mentioned at the start, he works off a lot of what Augustine has said, as well as Aristotle. And obviously, Augustine is quite famously known for his works on original sin and these feelings of guilt. And kind of, you can almost see a lot of Freudian stuff in Augustine, this kind of relationship with sex and this guilt that he feels towards these things. And that one of the things that Augustine goes on about, and what I was going to say Aristotle, what Aquinas builds off him, is the fact that they are aware that there are these really strong appetites that are driving human behavior in ways as well. And you can look at like the fall of man and how that develops from there. And that human beings have to try really hard to overcome these natural urges for sex and stuff like that. And it's through the development of these societies and the way Aquinas is doing that, perhaps he's saying, well, I know you want to have sex and reproduce. Actually, what would be better for human flourishing with God is actually to get married and then have sex purely to have a baby. And then you raise that baby carefully, not just have sex whenever you want. So yeah, it's interesting. I think, well, they might not have called it the unconscious mind. They were obviously aware that there were certain urges that human beings had that they had to manage with their reason.
Right, give Freud's view quickly then. Is conscience just the unconscious mind? Is it just the function of his conscience?
Well, he would say that it's not all about the unconscious mind. So while there's obviously the superego that gives very strong messages about what is right and wrong, that you have to use reason to be able to interpret what your society thinks is okay. And that just because particularly if you have like a neuroses that says like, oh, you could never approach that person because you would be maybe making them feel uncomfortable, actually you might be misinterpreting that situation entirely. Maybe the person that you want to walk over to would be completely okay, and they're actually using a bit of reason is very important when making rational, conscious decisions.
Fantastic. I make that 2-2. So the decider is whether conscience exists at all. So I'm going to ask the question. I want a yes or no answer from either of you, and you can't give the same answer as the person before. Question 5. Does conscience exist at all?
Siggy. Yes.
Nice. Okay, Ollie?
Yes.
sorry, it's a draw this week on Philosophical Ultimatum.
Do you want any explanation on this?
No, yeah, no, that's, okay. We're flogging a dead
they
horse.
They both think the conscious exists.
Right.
Yeah. We're flogging a dead horse. That was Philosophical Ultimatum in all its glory. Where's Pop Pop Philosophy Quiz? Well, just when you think things can get any better.
Oh, God.
Pop, 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 pop.
Philosophy quiz.
Right, welcome to Pop Pop Philosophy Quiz, everyone's favourite part of the show.
Woo!
This week we're playing Thomas Freud, the famous psychoanalyst from the 13th century. Thomas Freud published The Id and the Ego and the Summa Theologiae. What a mind he was, what a great mind. Could say he's a bit of a synthesis, Andy. I know I like a good synthesis. So in the Tom corner, or the Thomas corner, we've got Thomas Matthew DeLonge from the American music band Blink-182s. And he also plays in Angels and Airwaves and lots of other fun, funky, groovy bands. And we've got Sigmund Freud, the Austrian neurologist and founder of psychoanalysis. So, I'm going to give you a quote, and your job is to tell me who the quote is from.
So, it's either going
to... Sorry. So, I'm going to give you a quote, and it's your job to tell me who the quote is from. So, it's Tom DeLonge or Sigmund Freud. Mr. Andrew Horton's jingle goes like this.
Oral.
And Mr. Ollie's Marley's jingle goes like this.
Anal.
Right.
No, I can't do that.
No, say phallic.
Latency. I'll do that.
Yeah, go on then.
Latency.
We're playing first to three. They say Einstein died while he was still trying to figure out gravity. I think I'm going to die still trying to figure out something about blank.
So you have to answer the question.
You have to tell me who the quote's from.
All right, so
I've just blanked out the word because it's blatantly obvious who it is. Do you want to take a punt?
Latency.
There we go.
I'm going to go with... Freud.
Unfortunately, that was Tom DeLonge, so that's a point to Andy, and the word was blink.
God.
Geometric shapes hold an energy pattern, and scientists did some experiments which say certain geometric shapes can affect matter around them. It's simply because when a human looks at a shape, they instantly receive energy from their brain.
Oral. Tom DeLonge.
That's Tom DeLonge. That's one all.
Scientific chap.
Conscience is the internal perception of the rejection of a particular wish operating within us.
Oral, Sigmund Freud.
It's 2-1. We're playing first 2-3 instead now. It's 2-1 to Mr. Andrew Horton. At the bottom, God is nothing more than an exalted father.
Oral, Sigmund Freud.
That's 3-1. And we'll play last point wins the game. Last score wins. Immorality, no less than morality, has all times found support in religion.
Oral. Sigmund Freud again.
Fantastic. Well, it's a whitewash for Mr. Andrew Horton. Commiserations, Mr. Ollie Marley.
It's okay.
Well played. If you've listened to this entire episode and you can hear my voice now, what you can do is answer the following question and tweet us at the PanSideCast with your answer. So, is this a quote from Sigmund Freud or Tom DeLonge? All I need is Tom DeLonge or Sigmund Freud in a tweet. I'll tweet you back. I'll give away 3 posters sent internationally. Wherever you are in the world, they'll get to you. Just tweet at the PanSideCast with the word Tom DeLonge or with Sigmund Freud. The ego has the task of bringing the influence of the external world to bear upon the id and its tendencies, and endeavours to substitute the reality principle for the pleasure principle, which reigns supreme in the id. Tweet as Tom DeLonge or Sigmund Freud. I think that one's from Dude Ranch.
I think that's from Buddha or Cheshire Cat.
There's a couple of hints there.
Please tweet us at the PanSideCast. Remember, we still have plenty of PanSideCast t-shirts, which you need to buy for all of your family and friends. Use your id to go to the shop and buy your friends a t-shirt because they really, really want one. They told me about it. Please also leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. Everything you do for us really supports the podcast. Remember, this is a community project. Any feedback is fantastic for us. So please give us that 5-star review. That would be fantastic. Support all of our social media. Remember, we're doing philosophy here. It's a discussion between you, the community, and us. And we really appreciate everything you do for us. So any promotion of the show for us would be absolutely fantastic.
Thank you. You've been listening to the wonderful, beautiful, soothing voices of Mr. Ollie Marley.
From Summa Theologica, St. Thomas Aquinas, conscience is reason making right decisions.
And Jack Symes.
I am, as a rule, always ready to acknowledge my debts to other workers, but on this occasion, I feel myself under no such obligation.
And me, Andrew Horton, once again from Thomas Aquinas, from Summa Theologica, goodness and being are really the same.
Find out on the next episode of the Pan Sidecast, who wants to sleep with their mum? Spoiler alert, it's all of us. According to Freud. According to Freud, anyway. Aquinas wouldn't say so.